From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Iranians marched through the streets of Tehran today, mourning Qasem Soleimani, the general killed by a U.S. strike on Friday, and chanting death to America. Iran announced yesterday that it is abandoning the limits on uranium enrichment set by the 2015 nuclear deal. And we're going to hear many voices on the situation today. Joining us now is Republican Congressman Michael Waltz of Florida, who has praised Soleimani's killing. Congressman, welcome. And weeks ago, Iranians were protesting their own government. Now today, they're in the streets in solidarity. Our ally Iraq has voted to expel U.S. troops from that country. The Iranians have dealt another blow to the nuclear deal. How can you say the U.S. is better off now than before Soleimani was killed?
Well, let's unpack that just a bit. Those are Iranian government supporters in Tehran. Most of the protests that were happening against Iran were in rural areas and with amongst the Kurds, the Arabs, the other non-Persian parts of Iran. Secondly, the Iraqi government that just voted to, which was largely a symbolic vote, is actually already resigned because of the anti-Iranian protests in Iraq, and the current prime minister, Mahdi was seen as a kind of a pro-Iranian stooge. So I think there you need to unpack that a bit. But at the end of the day, I think the president had actionable intelligence that Soleimani was working through his militia leaders in Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and elsewhere to continue after a long history of attacking American assets, and most recently our embassy, to continue those attacks. And frankly, as a member of Congress, I would have found it irresponsible to not take action. We don't wait until there's additional American body bags coming home to then stop the threat.
But the administration has said that they took the action because of an imminent threat. And the reporting is indicating that the threat was no different than it has been for years. Have you seen intelligence of an imminent threat that prompted the killing
of Soleimani? I'm going over to the White House tomorrow to get some of that intelligence. And then we expect broader briefings this week as Congress comes back in session. And we'll gauge what that, you know, how imminent that threat was. But at the end of the day, this is an individual that the Obama administration designated as a terrorist and has a long history of directing attacks against Americans all over the world.
But doesn't this just escalate a very volatile situation?
Well, no, I think this was a response to an escalation. The Iranians have been escalating, whether it's shipping drones, storming our embassy. There's been a history of escalating just to a point where they think we'll respond forcefully and then backing down. But I think they've miscalculated in this case.
Well, many people think that the administration, though, has miscalculated.
Of course you do. So that's your reflexive response.
Are you talking about me or?
I think the media's reflexive response is to shoot holes in anything this administration does. But at the end of the day, this is something that's been contemplated by multiple administrations. This administration decided to take this step to take out a declared terrorist. In self-defense, I think it was clear from an authority standpoint, and you may disagree with the policy, but deterrence is incredibly tricky and difficult, and particularly with a regime that continues to conduct malign activities across the Middle East.
What is the end game here on the part of the administration? Because President Trump, who says he wants to de-escalate the situation, says he doesn't want war with Iran, then went out and tweeted that, you know, there are 52 sites within Iran, including cultural sites, that he would be willing to attack.
Well, with deterrence, you need to send very clear signals. And the Iranians have now heard, the Iranian regime has heard loud and clear that if you continue to escalate, you will be met with an even more forceful response. And in many situations in the past, again, you know, the Reagan administration sank half the Iranian Navy in response to an attack on one of our frigates. And what was Iran's response? It stepped back and it stepped away from any further escalation. We've seen this time and time again where the regime is emboldened by perceived weakness. Frankly, I called for the Trump administration to take a sharper and stronger response in response to the Iranians shooting down our drone. And I think that would have caused the Iranians to step back months ago. But in this case, I think at the end of the day, you will see the Iranians respond symbolically. They will take some type of response because they have to for their own domestic politics. But they do not want war with the United States because they know they will lose. At the end of the day, the Iranian regime cares about its own survival the most.
I want to ask you one more thing, Congressman. The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said yesterday that the House will vote this week on a resolution to limit the president's war powers against Iran. How will you vote on that bill, and what do you see as the significance of that vote?
Well, I think she's conflating two things. Many, including Speaker Pelosi, are saying the president is not authorized to go to war with Iran. And I think what they're saying there is we're not putting boots on the ground in Tehran. We're not invading Iran D-Day style. And, of course, the president would have to come to Congress for that type of operation. But to defend our soldiers and our embassy in Iraq against an imminent attack is completely within his authority. So I'd have to see the language of what they put forward.
But you haven't decided yet how you would vote on that.
Well, if it is limiting the president's authorities in the latter, to defend our assets overseas and including in Iraq, then I would vote against that. If it's limited to saying the president has to come to the Congress for some type of authorization to conduct an offensive operation against the country of Iran, that would be very different. And again, I'd have to look at it.
Mm-hmm. That is Republican Congressman Michael Waltz of Florida. Congressman, thank you.
Okay, thanks so much.
Now to Australia, where thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes as fires reach the fringes of residential areas in Sydney. And even though rain and cooler temperatures are expected today, the relief may be short-lived as conditions are expected to get worse later this week. At least 25 people have died, nearly 2,000 homes destroyed, and more than 12 million acres of land burned. It's also estimated that nearly half a billion animals have been killed in the fires since September. Our next guest came up with a number using a guide from the Worldwide Fund for Nature report produced in 2007. The report calculated the impacts of land clearing on the estimated Australian mammal population density in the country's most populous state, New South Wales. But in reality, the situation for Australia's wildlife could be much worse. Chris Dickman is an ecologist at the University of Sydney. Chris, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Half a billion animals killed in the fires. That sounds astounding. You say that that's a conservative estimate. How much worse do you think the impacts to wildlife could be this fire season in Australia?
Well, it's certainly conservative because they didn't include some of the species groups we didn't have any density information for. Mm. So the numbers don't include bats, for example, and the bats are likely to be very susceptible to the bushfires.
Did you say bats?
Don't include frogs. Yeah, bats.
Bats, frogs, and what other types of animals?
Invertebrates, fish that would be affected potentially in the creeks running through these areas.
You know, for many of us, when we think of Australia, we think about the vast wildlife. There was actually a video that captured a woman trying to rescue a baby koala that has gone viral. Aside from the fact that this is heartbreaking, tell us more about the potential consequences of losing so many animals.
Yeah, well, as you say, the animals like the koalas, some of the possums, some of the gliding marsupials are really iconic. The species that occur nowhere else. It's not to say that we'll lose them per se in terms of whole extinctions, but these species are likely to decline to very low numbers over large parts of their ranges. And there are probably local extinctions that we can expect as a consequence. And many of these species as well are really important from an ecological point of view. So, for example, the flying foxes, the largest of the bats, are very important in moving seeds and pollinating flowers in trees. With the loss or diminishing numbers of these species, we're likely to see slower forest regeneration. With species on the ground as well that are important for turning over the soil or moving seeds or dispersing fungal spores, we're likely to see, again, slower regeneration if these species are lost.
You've been working in this field for more than three decades. You know, this is the worst that we've seen from here, but how would you compare the impacts that wildlife in Australia are seeing this fire season compared to past years?
I think in terms of anything that I've seen, anything in the historical record, it's probably worse in this fire season. It's partly because the fire season started early and also because of the very great extent of it. It's millions of hectares. Some of the fires are very intense. And they've also come at the end of a long-term drought. So populations of many species are likely to have been small when the fires kicked in, and a little bit more vulnerable than they might have been otherwise. So we're probably seeing the worst fire season for the native animals here, that we have on record.
It's just devastating for everyone, for the animals, for the nature, vegetation, and also for the humans.
It is. It's just a catastrophe. And I guess the only silver lining that many of us can see and hope for is that we'll have some deeper thinking to emerge from it about what we can do to reduce the extent of such catastrophes in the future. But for the moment, it really is a grim situation, and it's continuing to develop.
Chris Dickman is an ecologist at the University of Sydney. Chris, thank you so much for this update.
Thank you, Tonya.
Members of Congress are back in Washington after the holiday break, where the upheaval in Iran has taken center stage, as well as next steps in the impeachment process. Today, former National Security Advisor John Bolton tweeted that he'd be prepared to testify if the Senate issues a subpoena. For the latest on both stories, we have with us NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez, who joins us from Washington. And Franco, as I mentioned today, Bolton tweeted, quote, "I have concluded that if the Senate issues a subpoena for my testimony, I am prepared to testify." How does that change the calculus on impeachment?
Well, it is a big deal. Bolton was, Trump's top foreign policy advisor when Trump put a hold on security aid to Ukraine and asked the Ukraine president Zelensky to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden and his son. When Bolton was fighting the House subpoena on behalf of his deputy, he teased investigators that he had firsthand knowledge of meetings that had not been made public. Mm. All that said, though, it is important to remember that there are no signs that the Senate is going to issue subpoenas for witnesses. Mm-hmm. And right now, the White House is telling us that all this is hypothetical until Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, actually sends up the articles of impeachment.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a moment. On Fox News yesterday, Republican Lindsey Graham actually called for the Senate to pressure Speaker Pelosi to deliver the impeachment articles. Let's listen.
What I would do if she continues to refuse to send the articles as required by the Constitution, I would work with Senator McConnell to change the rules of the Senate so we could start the trial without her if necessary.
What are you hearing about when Pelosi actually might act?
Well, we've been checking, including this morning, and there is no update on Pelosi's decision. Now, the House will be back tomorrow, and we'll see what she says then. I will also note that some Democrats have said they expect the trial to begin this week.
Okay. The other big story are the developments involving Iran. The House is expected to vote on a war's powers resolution to limit the president's ability to strike Iran. What effect will this action have?
On a substance, probably not that much. Pelosi says lawmakers are concerned that the Trump administration acted without consulting Congress. But reality, Congress has tried and fallen short of trying to rein in these kind of powers before. This measure specifically is likely to pass the Democratic-controlled House, but don't really expect it much to happen in the Republican-controlled Senate. Where President Trump has a lot of power, and President Trump certainly isn't appearing to take the criticism very seriously, putting out on Twitter that he'll serve notification via his tweets.
Yeah, he also said last night on Air Force One, he doubled down on his threat to target Iranian cultural sites if Iran kills Americans in response to the targeted killing of Soleimani. How has this threat gone over in Washington?
A lot of concern, a lot of debate. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo had to address the matter on Sunday talk shows. Interestingly, he appeared to walk it back, saying the U.S. would behave inside international laws. But despite those comments, that's when, as you noted, Trump, doubled down, and Trump said he was undeterred during his talk on Air Force One. He basically said, you can't kill Americans but expect your own cultural sites to be untouched. He said it doesn't work that way.
Mm. No Republican has really openly and directly criticized the president on this targeted killing. But is there concern behind closed doors? Are you hearing any talk?
Well, we haven't heard so much talk yet. You know, the Republicans have been on recess, and it's been a little harder to get to them, except for press releases. Rand Paul of Kentucky, he did raise some questions and tweeted that Trump should have asked for congressional approval before authorizing a drone strike. I would get our listeners to remember that earlier this year, Rand Paul, as well as Senator Mike Lee of Utah, Susan Collins of Maine, and Jerry Moran of Kansas, they all were Republicans who joined Democrats who wanted to limit Trump's ability to launch a war with Iran. That measure did not pass, of course, but it was something to watch.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about how all of this pertains to the 2020 presidential election. Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren has said she questioned the timing of this strike, and other Democratic candidates have also joined in expressing concerns. What kind of bind does this targeted killing put on the presidential candidates with the short amount of time I have with you?
Well, it presents an opportunity as well as challenges for both the Democrats as well as President Trump. Elizabeth Warren appears to be suggesting Trump ordered this strike for his own political purposes. This could be a fresh opening for some of the anti-war voices among the Democratic candidates who could hear some of that during the Iowa caucuses. Bernie Sanders can highlight his opposition to the Iraq war. He has now vowed to stop a war with Iran. Meanwhile, Biden and Buttigieg, they're kind of offering a little bit more nuanced criticism. They're criticizing the methods, but they're also noting that Suleiman was a really, really bad guy.
Yeah, that's Franco Ordonez. He is NPR White House correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And as you heard Franco talk about some of the presidential candidates being vocal about Iran and the killing of General Soleimani, Elizabeth Warren isn't the only one. With the Iowa caucuses less than a month away, many of the candidates were there over the weekend talking about Iran, including two of the front runners, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters reports on the shift towards foreign policy coming in the final weeks ahead of the caucuses, which is also when many people are making up their minds.
Former Vice President Joe Biden is sitting with his elbows on a table at one of his field offices in Waterloo, Iowa. He holds a flip phone to his right ear. His left hand covers his other ear in this noisy office as he calls possible supporters in the state.
I'm good. I'm calling to see if you consider caucuses in Maine on February the 3rd. I sure could use your help.
At each of Biden's Saturday events, Iowa Congresswoman Abby Finkenauer introduced him. She defeated a Republican incumbent in 2018, and she's one of the youngest women ever elected to Congress. She's also the only member of Iowa's congressional delegation who has endorsed a presidential candidate. Before the phone calls in Waterloo, Biden and Finkenauer spoke to a small crowd.
The working class kid from Scranton, Pennsylvania, our next president, Joe Biden.
Toby Cole was there. He says he is leaning strongly towards Biden.
Vice President Biden has the best chance of unifying people from all, pulling in the independents and some disgruntled Republicans. I think he has the best. I personally think he has the best shot at that.
It's still a crowded field, and Iowans have had the chance to see many of the candidates several times. Part of Biden's pitch is that his time as vice president has prepared him to work with foreign leaders. During a town hall in Des Moines Saturday night, Biden talked about President Trump's order to kill top Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani. While Biden says no one should weep over his death, the last thing the U.S. needs is another war in the Middle East.
All this just reinforces the stakes of this election, in my view. That's why it's so important to elect someone who's already ready on day one when they're elected to pick up the pieces of this disarray and immediately be a commander in chief of our armed forces.
That's a convincing argument for Peggy Magner. She saw Biden twice over the weekend. After seeing him speak at an elementary school cafeteria in the small town of Vinton, she told me she is probably going to caucus for him.
I think he has the experience we need. I think what has happened over in the Middle East is just horrible. And I think we need someone like Joe Biden to help us because I think he gets it. And I'm not sure anybody else really does.
That argument likely will not persuade Jesse Rasmussen from Carroll, Iowa. Rasmussen was part of the crowd of around 1,300 people who came to see Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders in Des Moines on New Year's Eve.
I've been a supporter since 2015. I've met him a couple times. This is like my fifth rally or something I've been to.
Hillary Clinton just eked out a victory over Sanders here 4 years ago in the caucuses. Rasmussen says she likes Sanders' consistency and thinks he has a better pulse on America than Biden.
Bernie's been fighting for the same things his entire life. Like, the past 40 years, he's been fighting for universal health care since the 70s. I mean, he's the one who's got the credibility and the integrity.
Sanders was also in the state over the weekend responding to the killing of General Soleimani. He called it a dangerous escalation towards another disastrous war in the Middle East.
I wanted to say a few words regarding the developing situation in Iraq and Iran.
At a rally in Dubuque on Saturday, Sanders reminded the crowd of his opposition to the Iraq war.
I believe the first course of action is for the Congress to take immediate steps to restrain President Trump from plunging our nation into yet another endless war.
In the run-up to this year's Iowa contest, Sanders and Biden have remained at the top of polls here throughout last year. A CBS poll out yesterday showed them in a three-way tie with former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Senator Elizabeth Warren was close behind, followed by Senator Amy Klobuchar. However, things have been known to change dramatically in the last minute in Iowa. But one thing is likely: the Democrats will stack their judgment on foreign policy up against President Trump's as they make their closing arguments here. For Here and Now, I'm Clay Masters in Des Moines.
Markets were down and oil prices were up this morning as anxieties about Iran continue to rattle investors. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger, CBS News analyst and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So between Friday, after the news broke about Soleimani's killing, and today, what's been going on?
Friday was a pretty big sell-off, a little bit less than 1%, but I would also caution people to not read too much into that. It was a pretty thin session, not as many people back to work. Today is really going to be the big test. We started the morning with stocks pointing much lower, but frankly, stocks have been clawing their way back here in the United States. One big beneficiary of this, of course, has been oil. Gold, really big safe haven, up 1% to a 7-year high. Probably the biggest beneficiary of all of the new news of the last 3 or 4 days.
Well, let's talk about oil. President Trump has threatened sanctions on Iraq if it follows through on forcing U.S. troops out of that country. Iraq is the second largest oil-producing country in OPEC behind Saudi Arabia. If the president does put sanctions on Iraq as he is threatening, how would that affect oil prices?
You know, I think it would obviously put pressure on oil prices, and I guess this is a little bit less of an issue for the United States, but it is still incredibly important for the entire world, right? Because the United States has become less reliant on the international markets because shale production in the U.S. has basically doubled over the last 10 years. But if you look at a place like Asia, where Japan and China are extraordinarily reliant on oil, so too is Europe. And when you see that world oil prices, prices of Brent crude going up to $70 a barrel, that catches the attention of everyone. So I think it's important. We talk a lot about how, wow, we're energy independent. Well, the second, third, fourth largest economies in the world are not. And so the price of oil rising could have a very impactful impact. Yeah, no, I was a dummy. It's the first day back. Sorry.
That's all right.
But it will have a tremendous impact on the global economy specifically. And I think that's really important to remember.
Well, and if oil prices do go up, you know, a lot of people look at car sales are affected by that. We were just talking recently about how huge SUVs are doing really well right now because gas prices are so low. Airline ticket prices, what are you watching for there in terms of if oil prices keep climbing?
I'm looking at something slightly different. I think that oil is sort of the obvious red herring here, right? Because that a spike in oil, if we got to $100 a barrel here in the U.S. and gas prices went up, that clearly would be a problem, right? But what I'm starting to look at is I'm wondering if international companies are going to start pulling back on some of their spending plans for 2020. Remember, in 2019, United States businesses did not spend a lot. The consumers did all that heavy lifting. And 2020 was supposed to be the year where companies said, all right, we're back in it. Trade war doesn't seem to be as big an issue. We're going to spend money. Now, with this uncertainty in the Middle East, are big multinationals going to pull back? And I'm really looking at that. I'm looking at shipping routes, and I'm looking at what happens with all of these routes throughout the world, how this trickles throughout the economy.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks.
Take care.
Let's get back to our top story, the situation with Iran. I spoke today with Chuck Hagel, former Republican senator and secretary of defense. Hagel was in the Obama administration during the rise of ISIS. And I asked him about the news that American forces in Iraq and Syria are stopping their campaign against ISIS as they prepare for possible retaliation from Iran.
Well, this is a direct result of what the president ordered in the killing of Soleimani. If that would not have been the case, he wouldn't then have had to make these decisions to pull back on going after ISIS. It just so convoluted the whole process. So now we're pulling back on our real, clear, vital enemy, the vital enemy of nations in the Middle East, and going and helping them go after ISIS. And what have we achieved with that?
Secretary Hagel, if you were defense secretary today, what would be your top concerns when it comes to the revenge that Iran has vowed after the killing of Soleimani?
Well, this is a direct result of what the president ordered in the killing of Soleimani. If that would not have been the case, he wouldn't then have had to make these decisions to pull back on going after ISIS. It just so convoluted the whole process. So now we're pulling back on our real, clear, vital enemy, the vital enemy of nations in the Middle East, and going and helping them go after ISIS. And what have we achieved with that?
Secretary Hagel, if you were defense secretary today, what would be your top concerns when it comes to the revenge that Iran has vowed after the killing of Soleimani?
Well, Iran possesses significant asymmetric weapons, meaning it's got its Quds forces, its Revolutionary Guard, Hezbollah, Popular Majority, militia forces, Shia militia forces, all over the Middle East, and they have significant cyber capability, and that's probably as big a threat as anything. You've got the Persian Gulf, where so much commerce and oil come down through that narrow Straits of Hormuz. They've got capabilities there with their navy. I mean, it is presenting the Defense Department a lot of big challenges because of all those asymmetric capabilities that Iran possesses. They can hit really in any location at any time by different means. I don't know what the Iranians will do. They say they're going to do something, but we've got to be prepared for anything. And then that means, of course, we had to evacuate all of Americans, told them to get out of Iraq. We're taking many of our people in the embassy and evacuating them as well. We're on high alert all over the Middle East. American civilians, American business are all targets, of course. Now, I know Iran has said that we're going to hit military facilities, but I wouldn't bet on that 100%. So it's a big problem.
Well, and the U.S. has already sent thousands more troops over to Kuwait. Do you expect more U.S. troops will have to go to the region?
Could be, depending if this escalates in any significant way. And both sides I know they're saying we want to de-escalate and we don't want war, both sides are saying, but their actions are saying something different. So we could see more troops.
Well, that's the question. I mean, if Iran does retaliate, as they are saying that they will, wouldn't the U.S. have to then retaliate for the retaliation?
Well, I suppose we would, and that's how World War I started. And you go back into the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution that really started the Vietnam War in 1964. President Bush and his administration telling the Congress and the American people that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction and we have to stop that, which now we know he didn't. That was untrue. Yes, that's right. It always, and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Let's talk about the Iran nuclear deal, because that's a big part of this, too. And you were, of course, part of putting that together. And Iran now says it's ending its commitments to that deal in light of the killing of Soleimani. What do you make of that? And do you think there's any way to get diplomacy with Iran back on track at this point?
Well, I hope so. The 2015 nuclear agreement was a very significant agreement because, one thing, it started to stabilize things in the Middle East. It didn't end all the hostilities, of course, but at least it started us down a road of de-escalation and down a road where we could build some trust with all the nations and Iran. Let's remember, the people who signed that agreement were all the great powers, China, Russia, all our Western allies, NATO, United Nations, United States. That was significant. And we stopped the centrifuge production. And it was a big deal. For the first time, it put United States inspectors inside Iran on the ground in those facilities. So it was a good step forward, and it helped stabilize some of the relationship. So when the president pulled us out of that agreement, what was interesting, all of our European allies stayed in it. We isolated ourselves. The president isolated the United States in that agreement. Every other signatory to that agreement stayed in it and told us that that was a mistake. Well, then we put sanctions, significant sanctions on Iran, and started hitting Iran hard economically, diplomatically, and other ways. And then now with this event that killed Soleimani, that kind of just capped it off. So the Iranians say, there's no way we're going to make this work, and we're going to just start the centrifuges up again. I understand that. That's predictable. So we've got a bigger problem than we had a week ago.
Well, and the Trump administration would say, and they have said, that they thought it was a very bad deal and that it only dealt with the nuclear issue and not with the fact that Iran was, through surrogates in parts of the region, attacking U.S. interests and that the deal didn't cover that.
That's true. But it dealt with the most significant threat that we all felt, we being not just the United States, but our allies, NATO allies, actually China and Russia also, the nuclear capability that Iran was starting to possess. Iran was not going to deal with the other two issues that you just mentioned. They agreed to the nuclear deal. What this would do and was doing was building, as I've said, some amount of trust between all the countries to start dealing with the other components of the problems that we've been dealing with Iran, the terrorism, and the mischief that they've been making in Lebanon and everywhere else, and their missile component. And so we were moving toward dealing with those. Now we have no base to work from. Now we have no platform to try to fix some of these other problems and address those. In diplomacy on these big issues, it doesn't come in neat little boxes. Well, let's take all three of the big issues and we'll negotiate them, and then we'll come up with an agreement. Doesn't work that way. I wish it would, but it doesn't work that way. And I think the efforts that were made by John Kerry and Ernie Moniz, Secretary of Energy, the president, and others who were involved there was very significant.
I finally want to bring this back to Washington because the Senate comes back this week and was supposed to start its impeachment trial within days. Do you think that that trial should go ahead as planned?
Well, I think it has to. I mean, we're the greatest nation on earth. Come on. We can't walk and chew gum at the same time. I mean, impeachment is a big deal. This president was impeached. Now, I know a lot of people don't like it, don't like the way it was done, but it was done legally, lawfully, within the boundaries of the Constitution. He was impeached. So the next step, that didn't mean he was convicted, but the next step is then to try that impeachment in the Senate. I don't think you can stop these things. I mean, again, that's a victory for Iran. I mean, I think the rest of the world would look at us and laugh that as great a nation as we are, we can't do a couple of things at the same time. We can't govern our own country internally at the same time we can deal with foreign policy issues and national security issues. I mean, I just think it's ridiculous to even be talking about it.
Well, do you think that the Iran situation changes the calculation for Republicans who are thinking about voting to allow witnesses to testify in a trial?
I don't think it should. I don't see how it should. The two articles the president was impeached on have nothing to do with Iran. And I think the witnesses that I think should be called, they, I mean, that's what a trial is about, witnesses, so that the senators, the jurors, can listen to the evidence, the real evidence on both sides, and then make a decision whether you think the president should be exonerated or convicted. So I don't think it has anything to do with this.
That is Chuck Hagel, a former Republican senator from Nebraska and former Secretary of Defense under President Obama. Secretary Hagel, thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
People living with movement disorders like Parkinson's disease and essential tremors have to deal with uncomfortable shaking that can make it hard to do something as simple as drink from a cup. But some have had success with treating their condition with neurostimulators, devices implanted in the brain during a procedure called deep brain stimulation surgery. New research suggests it could also be used to treat seizures in some patients with epilepsy. Cheryl Sanson is one success story. She had neurostimulators implanted 5 years ago to treat essential tremors, and she joins me now to talk about it. And Cheryl, first, just describe for our listeners what this condition meant for you before you got this treatment.
It seems that stress brings it on even worse, but I can't do any fine motor things that we take for granted, like putting makeup on. I couldn't even put on makeup. I couldn't even use a key to get into my house or anything. The shaking gets so severe that I pretty much resorted to just eating finger foods whenever we went out because it was too embarrassing to use silverware.
Your son jokes that you're a cyborg now. Can you tell us a little bit about how these neurostimulators actually work? I'm reading that they're connected by wires to a device on your chest.
Yes. What they do is they did an MRI of my brain, and they mapped out the location of where they were going to place the stimulators. And then I went into a two-part surgery. The first part was to embed the wires into my brain. And then that part I was awake for so that they could make sure that everything was in the correct spot.
Was that scary?
It was very scary. It really was. I was shaking terribly.
Oh, wow.
But, yeah. And then the second part of the surgery was a week later where they implanted the battery that's in my chest, and that's where I can turn the stimulator on and off, and I can make minor adjustments on it if I need to.
What does that feel like when you're adjusting it?
Actually, they've gotten it down so precisely that I don't feel anything. You know, when it was first implanted and we first turned it on, it was like a two-hour appointment of doing adjustments, and I could feel like tingling going up my, like my jaw and my speech being, you know, affected. And so they had to make adjustments to take away all those side effects.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So now it's so precise that I don't even notice like when I turn it on or off.
Wow. That's amazing. You're a science teacher. You teach chemistry and biology at Eisenhower High School in Blue Island, Illinois. And I'm also reading that you're a former medical professional working in pediatrics at Loyola University Medical Center. And I thought it was so moving that you actually stood before your students to share more about your condition and how this device works. What was their reaction?
They were in shock because I always, they knew, like there were times that I would joke with them before I even talked about it, I would say, oh, you know, I had brain surgery, you know, 4.5 years ago. And they'd be like, what? What do you mean you had brain surgery? They had so many questions. How did it feel? You know, do you have trouble at airports? And, you know,
that's actually a good one.
Yeah, it was a good one. And actually, I do at times. It just depends. I usually try to carry my regulator with, just in case when I'm going through the machines, the metal detectors, it can possibly turn it off.
Yeah. You know, my grandmother has tremors. She's had them all of her life, but they've just gotten worse as she's gotten older. For those who love you, they probably would say, I didn't notice anyway, or I just, it's a part of who you are. But for you and your ability to function from day to day, this was really important.
It was very important because I noticed I'm a very independent person, and I noticed that I was losing my independence. Yeah. So, I mean, it was something I needed to do, and the medications weren't helping me at all. And it was getting to be real difficult for me to do certain things.
There is a growing market for these neurostimulators. As we mentioned, they could be successful in treating Parkinson's and epilepsy. Is this something that you've had folks talk with you about, or that you really encourage others to ask about?
Yes, it is. Actually, so I've had strangers contact me about the surgery, which it's the best choice I've made.
It's life-changing.
You know, to do this. Yes, yeah. It was completely life-changing.
That's Cheryl Sansone, who teaches chemistry and biology at Eisenhower High School in Blue Island, Illinois. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.